Turn with me to the book of Philippians. Philippians chapter 4, verses 10 through 14, found on page 1153 in your pew Bibles. Here we read the following words. But I, Paul, rejoiced in the Lord greatly, that now at last your care for me has flourished again, though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased. I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things, I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Nevertheless, you have done well that you shared in my distress. May God bless this reading of His Word. You've heard many preachers at this point preaching about the book of Philippians. I'm sure many have talked about the key word of the book, rejoice. And many have talked about the faithfulness of the Philippian people of the congregation in Philippi to Paul. But you know there is another reason that the book is written. Not only is it about rejoicing, not only is it about Paul's thankfulness for the Philippians themselves, it's also a thank you note. And so we're going to talk about this passage as a thank you note today. Now, I want to caution you a little bit, because I say thank you note, and you think of what your mother has required of you from the time you were young. You pull out the special stationery and you write a little note on it. And you say, thank you. And that is essentially the heart of your note. But this note is a little different. This is a full letter length, of course, as we have read. And it is also a thank you note that does not dwell on the gift itself. It's a little different than your thank you notes. It is a heartfelt expression of gratitude for money and for encouragement. Remember that Paul was under house arrest in Rome. I think this has to be one of the most nuanced thank you notes of all time. First, he rejoices, Paul rejoices in the concern of the Philippian church, and then he excuses them for not showing concern earlier. Second, he makes clear that followers of Christ can find contentment, and this is another key word for today, contentment, in good situations and in bad situations. Contentment does not come from the usual worldly things that we may think about. Third, Paul takes pain to say that he rejoices not because of the gift, not on account of receiving money, but because of the partnership in affliction that he shares with the Philippians. This partnership is a reflection of Christian union together in the church and also the Christian union in Christ. So in those three things, we see this thank you note unfold. First, we have concern and rejoicing. Second, we have the notion that you can be happy and content in all sorts of situations. And third, we have a picture of unity, which is sealed by a gift, which is given to Paul. And so let's think about the first step. The first step in this thank you note is to revisit one of Paul's favorite themes, rejoice. Paul has used this word as a command. You should rejoice. But now he uses it in reflection on his own experience. He rejoices because he receives the gift. And it's a natural segue. I tell you to rejoice. Let me tell you why I'm rejoicing. I'm rejoicing because I have received your gift. It underscores the teaching of the first three chapters of the book. This command, rejoice, is coming from a man, the command itself is coming from a man who, by human standards, does not really have a whole lot of reason to rejoice. So why is Paul rejoicing then? Let's talk about the standard thank you note, and then we're going to contrast this one. The standard thank you note might say something like, thank you for your donation of 200 denarii to the Defend Paul Fund. Nothing of that sort flows through this pen. You will not find an amount of money in here. You will not find even a mention of money in this particular passage. In fact, there's no word for gift anywhere in this little note. The recipient might wonder, if we were in the modern world, whether Paul had received anything at all. The receipt of the gift, though, was nowhere in doubt because it was personally delivered, you remember the name, by my favorite guy who I want to know more about, Epaphroditus himself. I want to know more about this fellow who is so faithful in so many things and is mentioned for his faith in bringing this gift to Paul. Even if it hadn't been personally delivered, if it was sent by whatever postal service, the personal bonds of friendship and faith between Paul and the Philippian church were so strong that the Philippians know very well the gift was received. So what is Paul thanking them for? He doesn't mention the gift, but he rejoices that the care of the Philippians has the gift has shown that your care for me has flourished again. And I want to talk a little bit about this word for flourish. There's a word behind it, anathalo, which is used only once in the New Testament. And when that happens, that's because it's a pretty special word. Now, it's interesting that the commentaries say, oh, this word was used once, and then they fail to mention something really interesting about where it was used before. You remember, of course, that the Old Testament scriptures that were read at this time were in Greek. It was known, well, at least it's known in the modern world, as the Septuagint. And in the Septuagint, the word is used quite a few times. It's common. You know it from Psalm 72. Waving grain, people in cities, growing and flourishing again. If you look at 72:16, you'll see where the word is used, is flourish. And in Psalm 90, verse 6, the grass flourishes and then fades. The word refers to plants who are beginning to grow again in springtime, which are beginning to grow again in springtime. It's a tree or grass being reborn after being dormant. And with the gift that Paul receives, he sees clearly that the Philippians themselves are blossoming in their affection for him, in their faith in the gospel, and where there are blossoms, there will be fruit. This word points ahead to the fruit that will come, and Paul sees the fruit that is coming from the Philippian gift and testimony. And I can tell you that a teacher has no greater joy than to see his pupils excel. There's a promise of good things to come in this word flourishing. And I do believe this word refers directly back to the Psalms which speak of growth and flourishing in the life before God. The word is full of promise and encouragement. And then Paul turns to the matter of making sure that his praise doesn't seem to drip with irony. Well, it's about time you got around to giving a gift to me. We might read it that way. Some people have read this passage that way. I think it gets it wrong. But how could you read that? I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. Perhaps you could say, okay, Paul is giving them a strong hint. I need more gifts. Bring them to me. That's not what he's saying at all. He emphasizes his confidence in the Philippians by saying, I know that you cared before, but you lacked opportunity to show me that care. I think one of the dangers that we have as modern people reading words like this is that we are so attuned to expect snarky and sarcastic comments that we're tempted to say that Paul is letting them know it's about time he received something. The Philippian gift, after all, arrived well after the time that Paul was in prison. But I challenge you to find one word of sarcasm in the whole of the book of Philippians. The entire book has such a flavor of a heart that is overflowing and rejoicing. There is no sarcasm in this whatsoever. Paul is simply saying, I am appreciative. And so he turns to the question of need, because a person who thanks somebody else for a gift can also be fishing for more. That's exactly what every fundraising letter does. If this is a fundraising letter, it's also a fishing line with a lure on the end saying, if you just give a little more, I'll reel it in and you'll have something even better that comes from my particular organization. Now, these have their place, but that's not what Paul is doing here. This is not a fundraising letter. He's not saying, thank you, and by the way, I need more. And how does he say this? He says this because his need might be great, but he is content. And this, I think, is where we get the most direct application to our lives today. So I'm going to spend some time on this idea of need, of being poor and being rich. A person in the desert who receives water responds with overflowing thanks, don't they? Is Paul starved for resources here? Yes. I guarantee you that one thing that Paul is not in his time in prison in Rome, he is not rich. He is poor. So he needs things. He needs money. He needs people. He needs food. He can't work. Ordinarily, when he's outside of prison, he works as a tent maker, but now he is definitely not working. At most, he is writing. He relies on charity. But he takes pains to talk about how his need hasn't influenced his rejoicing. He might need many things, and yet he rejoices. His contentment with life is independent of the money that might be in his bank account or is not in his bank account in this place. A cynic could read this as a guy who is saying, nope, I'm good, I don't need your money. But Paul does need their money and he accepts it. However, when he writes of his thankfulness, he has a much deeper point than mere human need, and this is where we can gain some understanding. He is saying that his joy springs from knowing people who are likewise concerned with following Christ. His joy does not spring from seeing five figures in his bank account or something like that. We should pause here to consider a very important point, maybe. Need versus contentment. We need certain things to live. We need food, we need water, we need shelter, we need clothing. We also need friendship, we need work, we need money. All of these things are legitimate needs for us in our lives. And yet so few people are content when they receive these things from their Creator. Have you noticed that? Do you find greater contentment in a rich country than in a poor country? I think you know the answer to that. People want more. When they have, they want more. So what makes a man content? Paul says he's learned a secret. And any secret that Paul learns is a good secret to know. Paul says he's learned a secret that very many people have been looking for. He's learned the secret of contentment. The world tells us some different stories about how to achieve contentment. Let's mention a few. By the way, in Paul's time, there were people who talked about how to achieve contentment in many different ways. I'm going to mention the ancient name, and then I'm going to mention a modern name that you may or may not be familiar with. The Stoics, teaching in Paul's time, taught that being free of passion, meaning emotion, having no emotion was the way to contentment. The Stoics are enshrined, you might say, in that beloved Star Trek character, Spock. Logic and reason reveal all. Level your feelings. Check your impulses at the door. Contentment and peace will follow if you are logical enough. Try that sometime when you're a new father. Had a baby? Oh, that's nice. On the opposite end, there were people in the ancient world who followed the line of Kirk, if you happen to know this character. Contentment comes from expressing every emotion that crosses your mind at whatever time it might. This is the mind of the man who says, is she cute? Then I'm in love. Or, you crossed my honor, therefore I will fight. And here I will find contentment. And I really prefer either one of those to the modern idea of contentment. Do you know what the modern nostrum is that we teach students in school even? It goes something like this. The way to contentment, we say, is to be yourself. Have you heard that? I imagine you have if you've listened carefully enough. I prefer the Stoics, or I prefer those who let their emotions hang out for the world to see and look for honor, to those who say, simply follow yourself. What a poor God to follow. If the Stoics are Spock-like and unfeeling, then the Kirks express themselves with vigor. But the modern followers of the advice to be yourself condemn all of us to a selfish expression of our inner two-year-old. And we could also talk about some other visions of what it means to be content, couldn't we? We could mention, drawing from Eastern thought, the Buddhist idea, learn that you're only a drop in the ocean. Your desires amount to nothing. You must quench your desires and be enlightened to know contentment. The point is, by mentioning these things, that the world has many answers about how to find contentment, none of which come remotely close to telling us how to be content equally if we are rich or if we are poor, if we are in a good place or we're in a bad place. Buddhists and Stoics have all found that they prefer not to suffer, even as perhaps they were able to bear up under it. Very few have found contentment in plenty and in want alike. I don't know about you, but I want this contentment. I don't want to live a roller coaster life where I'm at the top of the world one moment when I am rich and I am depressed the next when I lose it all. Because if there's one thing that's true about money, it is very easy to lose. Paul presents life as a path that leads between two extremes, poverty and riches, but he says that both will happen, and in these things, both, we can find contentment. So why is there the difficulty? Why do we have difficulty finding contentment in poverty and riches? Let's talk about poverty, then let's talk about riches, then let's talk about why both can be places where the Christian finds contentment. Poverty is difficult. Any poor person can tell you that. Poverty means not knowing where your daily bread will come from, or if it will come at all. It means uncertainty in your life. It means chaos. Poverty means temptations to envy, temptations to steal. Poverty brings instability. It means having 5 different houses in a year. But it also brings you face to face with the fact that your own survival is not dependent on your own good works, perhaps, but on the blessing of God and the help of your friends. Friends who love you when you're poor are friends indeed. And Paul was truly poor in this case, wasn't he? He wasn't working. He was depending on others for daily food and on the other people, like the Philippians, for money. He couldn't get news of the outside. It had to be told to him by someone else. In this, he was content. Some people have seen this and argued that poverty is necessary for faith. And I will say that for some people that is true. You need to know yourself here. For St. Francis, as he is called, of Assisi, a brother in the faith from years ago, it was necessary for him to give up everything he owned in order to obtain faith. But by itself, poverty is no path to spiritual enlightenment or to contentment, because we all know people who are faithless and poor, just as we know people who are full of faith and poor. We know people who are poor and content. We know people who are poor and extremely dissatisfied. So by itself, poverty does not bring contentment. What about riches then? Now notice that Paul doesn't even mention money. He doesn't mention the gift amount. But if you are poor, I imagine you have thought to yourself from time to time, wouldn't money solve most of my problems? It does solve lots of problems. Just think about the problems that money solves. It buys better houses. It buys good lawyers. It buys food that doesn't have to come from someone's generosity. You can buy things you like that way. And rich means that you can buy many things the poor only dream about. You can buy better health. You can buy better schools. You can buy better help for the annoyances that come your way in life. being rich has its perks. But does that mean that being rich leads to contentment? There's an experiment that's going on in the state of Pennsylvania. It was started in the year 1971. It's been going on longer in certain other parts of the world. And the experiment goes something like this. We encourage people as a state to give little bits of money that they can't afford to buy a fantasy of getting rich. You guys know what I'm talking about, right? This is the lottery. You're buying a fantasy of getting rich. And here's the part that really makes it stick. A few people do get rich. Suddenly, people who may have been poor before, and by and large, it is the poor that play the lottery, a few of them, a select few, will have money pour down on them, and they will be rich. So what's happened to those lucky few who have suddenly gained money and suddenly become rich? Well, you can read the stories on the internet. Most of them lose it, and then they lose more. And then they're more poor than when they began. Something like 80% of lottery winners have nothing left after 5 years. It's an extraordinary statistic. And it goes to show that the money that they received did not buy contentment. In fact, it bought warfare. Now, if you are a person who has become rich by earning your money, this does seem to make people a little more intelligent about how they use that money. But even there, will that money buy you contentment? Being content and being rich are surely not the same thing. And I'm sure all of you could say, you know people who are faithful and rich, you know people who are faithless, and scratching for that last little bit of contentment with their money. I've known people who are content, and I've known people who are discontent, and I've known people from all parts of the society around us. I've taught students from families that are a big part of American industrial history. You would recognize the names. I've taught kids who have no family and, in fact, have no place to lay their head every night. They go from couch to couch to couch, and they have no place to lay their heads. Happiness and contentment don't seem to track very well with those descriptions. I've recently read a study of gamblers that you might find interesting. In the study, researchers set up a gambling game, and they didn't tell people that what they were doing was actually rigging the game. They rigged the game so the participants would either win consistently or lose consistently, as they thought they were just merely gambling. And those who won consistently gave credit to themselves. My goodness, I must be a really skilled person at this game. You can guess what the losers did. They blamed the game itself. They blamed something in the room. It wasn't their fault. Neither was content. This strikes me as a good picture of the ridiculous things that the rich and the poor say. The rich man says, I've worked hard for this. I deserve it. The poor man says, the rich man took it. Neither is completely incorrect, but neither is fully content. Neither state of life leads to contentment or happiness. All things. Here is one of the most famous verses in the Bible. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Do an internet search on that sometime. Click on images, and you will get stirring posters with pictures of mountaintops and marathons and other things that people do that are great. One poster says, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. And then there are other words on it. Triumph, success, marriage, goals. All these are good things, by the way. But a true poster to represent this verse would also have other words on it. What would the other words be on it? Defeat, failure, death, poverty. Paul is making a huge claim here. He is not saying, as some preachers do who tickle the ears, he's not saying, I can do all things and become rich through Christ which strengthens me. No, remember where Paul is. He is content and he's in prison. He's not earning any money. He's dependent on charity. This is where Paul is. And his triumph is not in being rich. His triumph is in being content when he is desperately poor. His triumph is in knowing that he is content. Paul makes a claim that's bigger than any of the success hucksters that you can hear around you. He's saying that he can endure riches. Let's talk about that a little bit. He can endure poverty and then everything in between because of Christ's strength. We tend to remember the endure riches part because I think we're all a little like Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. Can't God just curse me a little bit with riches? But Paul's hope is not riches. Paul's hope is Christ. Paul's hope is present now because he sees the encouragement of the Philippians writing to him, giving him people like Epaphroditus, giving him money to support him. This is encouraging. His hope is also in the future. And it's not a vain hope at all. It's a hope that allows him to endure all sorts of hardship and all sorts of success. Because after all, as any lottery winner will tell you, enduring success and money can be more difficult than enduring the times of poverty. And so what is the strength that Paul boasts in here? I can do all things through the strength of Christ. Well, it's a funny thing to mention. Let's talk about weakness. In 2 Corinthians 12, Paul writes the following. Jesus said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I, Paul, will boast all the more gladly of my weakness, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me." The strength that Paul has is the strength of Christ. And I want to mention here what a strange religion we have in some ways. The Romans couldn't understand it. The modern world doesn't understand it. We find contentment by following and giving our lives to God. We find contentment by following and giving our lives to Christ, who was God, who humbled himself, who became man in full, and then triumphed. No, wait a minute. There's a little bit in between, isn't there? You go from God, it's a downward step to go to being a human. You become a human, it's a downward step to become a criminal, dying as a criminal on the cross. Jesus was as low as a person can get. He died as the most hated type of person. He died as a criminal. And then he did what few have ever done. He came back from the dead. And Paul's boast, if it's a boast, is a boast in his own weakness and Christ's strength. Christ chose to become weak. Jesus chose to walk among us for a while. And then he was raised from the dead. Jesus himself lived with everything, and he lived with nothing. Jesus himself traveled through this world and was brought into contact with the rich, with the poor, and with everyone in between. Do you know what he told everybody that he met? Do you know what the message was that John the Baptist brought first and then Jesus emphasized? Repent. Do you want to find contentment? That is Jesus' message to us. Repent. Follow me. Jesus, the most powerful God of the universe, was amazingly poor when he was here. Foxes have holes, birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. And so Paul says, I can do all things through Christ, which strengthens me. I can do all things through Christ, that all-powerful God who died a humiliating death, he strengthens me. And what can Jesus do for you? My hope for you is this. I hope that as you get to know Jesus better, you too learn this secret of contentment, which is not much of a secret after all. Paul doesn't find some secret in himself or in some old book lying on the shelf. He doesn't meditate to find it. He finds it in the simple pleasure of being with other believers and other Christians, and he finds the secret in the union with Christ. The union that he has with Christ shows Paul and shows us what the union with others around us should be. And in this union, there is strength. Do you boast in yourself or in enlightenment? Do you boast in logic? Do you boast in emotion and feeling? Sacrifice it all on the altar of Christ. Seek union with him. Seek union with every believer who calls on the name of Christ. That's where the secret is. It's not so secret anymore. The world knows about it. The word has gone out. But you will need to give up your ego and your pride in order to find it. But there was a brother once who said very wisely, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose." And that, in fact, is the message behind this thank you note that Paul sent to the Philippians and sends to us for our enlightenment and contentment as well.